This subject I've been working on in the last few years together with several other people. Srdjan Ostojic was my student until recently, and he is actually the main author of this paper. We worked together with Alak Shomfai, who is now at Oxford. He did simulations and many discussions with us, and so did Thijs Vlucht in Utrecht. And currently I'm discussing much of the further work with Martin van Hekken. Just a few words on granular matter. I'm sure nothing new. Just to define it and to set it, to distinguish it from other forms of matter, we're usually, in most physical theories, we discuss matter in such a way that the elemental objects are molecules or atoms, and on a larger scale than those, the material is homogeneous. And of course, that's not the case in granular matter. We deal with grains, which themselves are macroscopic or at least mesoscopic, so they have lots of internal structure. They tend to be rather different from each other. And to separate it from something like colloids, we also make the statement that thermal energy is low. It's insufficient to change the structure of, to set the particles in motion or to change their relative position. Some of the consequences are that there is constant dissipation, there is loss of energy, energy from the scales of the grains to lower scales, to smaller scales, and because there's dissipations, there's no thermal equilibrium. And actually, in the end, if you wait long enough, there is no motion, unless you keep it in motion artificially by keeping it, shaking a box with sand or something like that, or unless you look at a velocity scale that gets smaller and smaller. And so the granular matter is very distinct from atomic matter, but still it comes in typical states that we can recognize as gaseous, liquid, and solid. There are also lots of exotic phenomena which are specific to granular matter. I won't speak about those. In fact, I will discuss today solid or static granular matter, so granular matter that no longer moves. And about that, you can ask, of course, lots of questions. You can wonder about density fluctuations, how homogeneous is the material. You can think about the topology of the contact network. Contacts are important because the grains are so big that we can ignore forces at a distance. We only deal with contact forces. We can think about the probability distribution of local forces. How big is the probability that a individual force between two grains is very large or very small? And what I will be actually dealing with is this probability distribution, but not of a single force, but of the spatial structure of forces. Just to, as a further motivation perhaps, look here at a picture of a two-dimensional granular stack. You see particles, which are in this case circular, the disc-like particles. They're poly disperse, and you see all kinds of interesting structures in it. You see some holes, you see denser regions. It becomes actually more interesting when you look at the contacts. Yeah, you have a question? Say that again?
Are you going to tell us how that picture was generated?
How? Yes, I will tell how this picture was generated. Well, I can do it now if you want. I'll say more details later, but we followed Newtonian. Newtonian mechanics on semi-hard disks that move. They move in two dimensions, dissipating energy with every collision, according to and also the collisions are following certain mechanical rules. We assume that the particles are three-dimensional elastic objects, which will have a repulsive force when they bump into each other. And then after a long while, so this energy is dissipated, pressure is kept constant, and then when we stop, when the motion is small enough.
And we have random initial conditions.
We have random and, say, gaseous initial conditions, low density, free motion. Right.
So is there a gravity or is it just
no gravity, only pressure, homogeneous pressure. And in this is the same picture as the previous one. By the way, the particles are drawn slightly smaller than they really are, because often when you make them as big as they are, they seem to be bigger. And so when you see, when you look carefully, there is no contact here, but there is really a contact. I've drawn lines between the centers of particles that are in contact. And when you see this graph, of course, lots of mathematical questions can be asked about that graph. We won't do that. We look at the more sophisticated graph where all the contacts now are weighted with a number representing the strength of the force between them. And the first thing that strikes, at least me, when I look at that picture, is that the forces vary quite significantly from one to another. The thickness of the line here, as you have guessed, not only represents the force, but it's proportional to the size of the force. So you see, in this picture, you easily see, say, two orders of magnitude difference between the forces. Because forces are balanced, I'm looking at a stable static configuration, so the particles don't move. That means every force on a particle from one side must be balanced by a equal force from the other side, at least in total. And so typically, a thick line from one end continues in a thick line from the other end. Sometimes it's branches, like here. There is already, because of force balance, there is a tendency for the forces to aggregate in spatial structures, which you can see here. I mean, there is this big thick line going all the way through, and then somewhere here it fades out. And one of the questions you can ask, do these force lines have a typical scale? A scale other than the scale of the particles or the scale of the system? They may or may not have such a scale. And either of the two answers to that question might be quite interesting. I mean, if it's typical for a force line to end after about 20 particles, you want to know why 20. What does this 20 depend on? If you cannot find the scale associated with these force lines, that suggests that these force lines might have some scale invariance, and that is perhaps even more interesting. And it's that kind of question that we tried to answer with this investigation. Now, we started out with an analogy with percolation. In percolation, you consider, well, in one branch of percolation, you consider a lattice of which the sides are connected. Did I hear a question? No. The sides are connected with some probability, and this probability, the connectivity between two neighboring sides is independent of everything else. So, between every two neighboring sides, you toss a coin and decide whether the two are connected or not. You do this with a probability p, which is uniform throughout the lattice. And then you generate configuration, and one of the main questions is the question whether you generate in an infinite lattice also an infinite cluster of connected sites. Now you can change this process a little bit, changing the order, by associating with every link in the lattice a random number from some distribution, and then having done that throughout the lattice, you take a threshold P and you draw all the lines where this random number, say in the interval 0, 1, where that random number is smaller than P. Then, of course, I generate the configuration of this percolation process that I described.
Well, but this is true if this distribution is uniform.
Yeah, but if I take, if it's other than uniform, it's simply it's just a re-gauging of the function of P. It doesn't really matter, but
the critical P will change.
The critical P might change. Yes, the critical P might change.
The
question concerning the previous slide. Yes.
Do you have the same dispersion of the particular size of the particle on the display? If you take the
I didn't hear the first part of the question.
Would you have the same dispersion of the force if the size of the particle are all the same?
Yes. You mean if the particles are all the same size?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll come back to that. Then you still have randomness in the forces. I'll explain that later. So I can associate random numbers with the edges and then draw all the bonds where this random number is less than P. And the only distinction between the first description I gave is that I can vary P while keeping R fixed. And now, having done that, it's of course very immediate to say, well, I will replace these random numbers R by the forces between two particles. They're no longer independent. They must satisfy all kinds of restrictions. In fact, they satisfy definitely the balance restriction. But I can then go through the same paradigm and wonder if I generate an infinite cluster or not.
You just said that the forces are vectors, and the restriction you mentioned, the balance, is a vector equation. So they definitely are arrows, they're not numbers.
Correct.
So how can you replace numbers by arrows?
Well, I come back to also this question in more detail, but let me now give you the answer, the most trivial answer. I take the particles to be frictionless. That means all the forces are central, and they always are between the centers of the particles, and so having given the position of the particles, the further information is scalar.
Yeah.
But the balance equation is a vector equation.
And how do you ensure that in the distribution, so the distribution is not independent anymore?
The distribution, no, I'm not, okay. I am using, I'm going to use this paradigm of setting a threshold on R, but I generate these Fs simply by this molecular dynamics process. Okay. I'm using, I'm not saying that I'm doing percolation or something, I'm using some simple concept from percolation.
So the generation of the Fs is a non-trivial process.
It's completely non-trivial, it's very difficult, yes. And very time consuming.
Yes.
So this comes back to the question of the shape of the particles. I mean, the force is no slip, the force is normal to the surface, but not necessarily through the center of mass.
There
is the point of contact.
Non-spherical. These are slipping particles. These are particles without friction.
No, but you mentioned non-spherical particles.
Non-spherical,
particles.
Okay, that makes it more complicated. If you have non-spherical particles, then of course the molecular dynamics is more complicated, and the vector nature of the forces has more impact again. But I start with the most simple situation. And I'm doing then molecular dynamics to semi-hard spheres or disks. They're spheres in the sense that I take elastic forces that belong to the realm of elastic spheres. This comes from having two elastic rubber balls overlap with a small overlapping by a small margin, and then the force will be the 3.5 power of this margin when this overlap is positive. I take the particles to be polydispersed. There is an additional. Is this the correct word for a dashpot interaction? An interaction, and there is a force inversely proportional to the velocity, to the central velocity when the particles are in contact. So that dissipates energy. There's no energy dissipation otherwise. So there's no ambient air or something like that, which is seems to be a modern question in granular matter. We take the dynamics under constant pressure. So we start with a gaseous, very low density congregation of particles. We let them move. And we scale the volume in order to keep up the pressure. The whole volume is periodic in two directions. It's two-dimensional, by the way. Not in an essential, I mean, it's not essential in anything we do, just simpler.
So the pressure is just the averaged force on the piston?
No, there's no piston, but you can take a an intersection through the system and integrate all the momenta of the particles going through it, and that gives you the pressure.
But you have to have a time average because it fluctuates so much.
Yes.
We
doesn't matter. We scale the entire volume, but you could scale the volume of the particles just as well in the other way. And we terminate the simulation when all the velocities are under a pre-driven threshold, which is low enough so that after this time there's never any structural change.
But the simulation is, for all intents and purposes, continuing.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. There's no lattice. And then, and at the end, so the simulation is something that is pre-given. We started, in fact, with this guy, Alex Schonfey, joined us in this effort with data he had already produced in another context. So we simply, then of course, we needed some other data, and he produced more data for this particular project. But the history of the simulation is completely gone. We only have the end product. And in this end product, we now can set a threshold. Only the very strong forces are kept, and then you get clusters like this. You can lower this threshold a little bit, and you see larger clusters appear. And you can lower it further, and the clusters grow bigger and bigger. And what we then did is simply measuring the mean size of these clusters, mean averaging them over the particles. So I select the particle and I ask the particle, to what size cluster do you belong? And this answer I average over many configuration and over many particles. And then I plot this mean size as a function of the threshold. When the threshold is very high, there are only very small clusters, and when I lower the threshold, the clusters grow and grow. But just like in percolation, you want to avoid taking the infinite cluster into account, because it would dominate the distribution completely. And so you want to somehow kill the infinite cluster, but you have no way of saying something is infinite. So you take some fake measure of infinity. Mostly, we simply drop the largest cluster, always. The largest cluster is still very small here, so it makes no difference. And the largest cluster in this region is likely to be indeed the infinite cluster. And so what happens then is that this curve bends over and gets smaller and smaller, because the largest cluster is bigger and bigger here, and the remaining clusters get smaller and smaller on this end. And then, as you see here, we've done this measurement, if you call it that, with different size systems. That means different size substance systems of one large system that we started with. We did many simulations of about 10,000 particles, but then we looked at this end product via small windows of linear size 18 through 70, and you get this mean cluster size behaving roughly like this. And like some of you have seen finite size scaling calculations, we were able to collapse these graphs onto a single graph, at least within some tolerance, by scaling the vertical axis by some power of the system size, and also scaling the horizontal by some power of the system size, except that the horizontal scale was not scaled from the origin, but scaled from some selected critical threshold. So to get this picture from the previous ones, I have three numbers as fitting parameters: this exponent phi, the exponent nu here, and this fc. Yes?
What is the symmetry between horizontal and vertical? Because in your simulation, you didn't seem to posit that there was any difference between horizontal and vertical directions.
No, but horizontal and vertical, I meant the horizontal and vertical axis of this graph. There's no symmetry. The scale, that's right. One is the scale of the threshold, and the other is the actual size of the clusters. And so this looked promising, that there might be some something very similar to scale invariance as you see it in phase transitions, with a tuning parameter like temperature, or a percolation like a probability. And one of the questions that came up after we had seen this is, what do these numbers depend on? What happens if we change the physical parameters of the simulation? And the first parameter we played with was the pressure. Remember that the disks were semi-hard, so there is a scale in the pressure. We can scale it relative to the elastic modulus of the particles. And this is a low, this is the original picture that you saw. At low pressure, 1,000th part of the elastic modulus, you can make the pressure 10 times higher or 100 times higher. And the effect is that the forces become more uniform, the contact network is more triangular, and it looks very different. Of course, the overall scale is different. I mean, the typical force here is 100 times bigger than here. So I have used a different scale. So maybe these lines should have been a little bit thicker. But at least you can see that it's, at least you may see that it's more uniform. And we do the same with these pictures. And we get three scaling functions. And we notice that the exponents are, by and large, the same as we had before. They do not depend on the exponents seem to be universal with a grand word.
This is not jamming, this is not zero pressure.
It doesn't matter. It's I'll come back to jamming too.
So what's this new?
What's the value of this new?
No, I mean, what's the meaning of this new? What's the divergent length? Is there a
divergent? Well, the nu should give the divergence of the size of these, the linear size, say geometric size of these clusters, as a function of the threshold. So it's nu in
function of, yeah. Yeah.
as a function of the distance from the threshold to the critical threshold at C.
Yes, correct.
And percolation threshold means the critical value, of course, so there's a little bit of the terminology is slightly.
Oh, yes, okay, yeah, yeah. I have, okay, my F is already a threshold,
yes.
And FC is the critical threshold, yes, yes indeed. The means it's like a meta threshold. We could play with other physical parameters like the polydispersity. If you the original polydispersity was 20% in radius, you can lower it to 10% or 5%. At 5%, it's already quite crystalline. You see some big crystals and grain boundaries. The pictures look very different, but still you can see in this picture that the forces are random. The forces, of course, are generated by the history of molecular dynamics. And once you come to this stagnant situation, there is still small fluctuations, but by and large, this picture remains constant.
I'm noticing a couple of different pictures that there are some particles that don't have any forces at all.
Yes, funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like this guy. Yeah. Because, well, this is a fluke, and but this this is the result of the arbitrariness of our termination. We stop when the velocities are low below a certain threshold, and of course we should stop at infinity, at infinite time. We can't. We stop at some finite time, and at the moment we take the snapshot, it may be that this particle is just in flight. So it is not undergoing any force.
But there also
but
could be a cage.
There could be a cage, but even at a cage, it doesn't come to rest. It bounces, and
at
infinite
time.
Times, it must be in contact with at least two.
Maybe
it's
in contact with a zero force.
It could, yeah, it could be in contact, but okay, that is a contact.
Yeah.
If it's
yeah, so
it wouldn't show up. But of course, I mean, this is really, this is not mathematics, this is physics. And
it's the same reason for, in the first picture, there was one particle at least with just one line connecting it to the other particle.
Yeah, I mean,
it's the same story, right?
Same story. I mean,
it's just bouncing back from.
I don't worry about those events because they are very improbable and they will not change my data. But of course, if you ask more subtle questions, you might worry about them. Well, we did the same trick, and we find similar pictures. The exponents have not changed. And to see that not only the exponents, but also this function S is the same, we try to join all the data on a single graph. And this is all the data that you saw before. For this graph, I took as fit parameters the exponents in the size direction and in the threshold direction, an overall vertical and horizontal scale to the whole picture for every physical condition, as well as a threshold for every physical condition. Yes.
Are you saying the force network has the same properties in the crystal phase?
Well, the force network, at least for the purposes I'm using it now. I'm not saying that, of course, in a crystal it's a different kind of network, but the randomness of these force lines seem to be similar. We were surprised. I mean, it's not something that we expected. And we started playing with other physical parameters. The force law. I told you that we had Hertzian forces, fairly realistic forces as they are between rubber balls. We replaced those by harmonic springs with no effect on the quantities nu, phi, and s.
Harmonic on one side, there's still zero on the other side. Right?
Yes, yeah. A parabola on one side and zero on the other side, yes. Yes, not only repulsive forces. friction between the particles. Now the vector nature of the forces comes into play, but it turns out, so when we entered friction, what that means, what we allowed frictional forces to be under a threshold proportional to the normal force. Forget the name, Coulomb. This law, I forget, is it associated with Coulomb also? Coulomb friction, yes. Yeah. And so we can set this, we can set this upper limit, this friction. We played with it, we vary it between, say, zero, what we had already, and something like four. But in effect, the frictional forces were always much smaller than the normal forces in reality. So even when they were allowed to be much bigger, in reality they were much smaller. And it's then you always have the choice: what is this the threat, this F that used to be a scalar in the frictionless case, and now is a vector? Do you take the normal component, or do you take the length of the vector? And all that didn't matter in our simulations. In all cases, we found the same nu, phi, and S, at least within the tolerance that we could measure. I was quite surprised that friction didn't matter, but and we tried some extreme situations, but we haven't found it to make any difference. Another thing we tried later was shear stress, the overall shear stress. Now this is, to be quite honest, we didn't do this in the same general setting of molecular dynamics. It turns out to be very difficult to do molecular dynamics under shear stress. How we exactly did it is something, it's more in accordance of rules that I will explain later, so I'll leave it aside for now.
But the Gieser's test does not support shear stress, so what do you mean by shear stress?
Shear stress means
solid,
that,
right?
Excuse me?
It has to be a solid to sustain the shear stress.
That's right. I mean, you can, once you begin the solid, once you enter the solid region, you can allow your stress to be shearing, but then you can keep it up in principle. But the what we did in practice is, maybe I'll leave that till later, because
it's break up. Does the stress apply just at the boundary?
Yeah. In some cases, yes. In other cases, we took it to be periodic, and you still can put up shear stress.
So even in the bulk?
Yeah. Well, shear stress means that the stress tensor is is not, what do you mean? It's it has different diagonal components.
So does that turn out to be the same as changing spheres to ellipses?
We don't know, because we haven't changed sphere to ellipses. So what happens is that we, when you put on shear stress, you mean that means anisotropic stress. You can always counteract that by measuring space also anisotropically and taking rectangles rather than squares. And the anisotropy in space and the anisotropy in force were not the same. They're also not connected by nu, this exponent nu. I come to your question. Thank you. But in all cases, we found that if you do the compensation, you can find compensational anisotropy in space, so that nu and phi and s are still the same. Yeah.
I want to ask you about another value. So if you look at the distribution of f and put on the edges independent copies of this distribution. Without any dependency, do you get the same exponent or do you get the different exponent? You forget about the fact that it's satisfied by this equation, you just look at the distribution and you put it independently.
No, that problem, if you do that, you come to ordinary percolation.
And the parameters you get are different.
Yes, these exponents are different from percolation. That is to say, the nu is quite different. The phi is not different enough to say that it is different. And the s, the scaling function, is different. But I must admit that I have to do. I have to look at that again because the scaling function depends on this, on the precise process that you do also by taking out the infinite cluster. How you do that, it depends critically on the boundary condition, and I should compare percolation and this force network with the same boundary conditions to be quite precise. So we found that shear stress does not seem to change the universality class. It changes the isotropy, but it doesn't change the exponents. And you can increase this shear stress to the point where the stack no longer behaves like a solid. Then, of course, you can't do it anymore. But even very close to this yield point, we found the same exponents. And we didn't. So I was certain beforehand that. When we started doing this, these simulations, here I expected what came out. I expected shear stress can be put on marginally, and I can't believe that that really changes anything. But of course, when you come to another phase, something must change. So this nu and phi, these exponents must change at the yield stress. But it didn't. What we saw was it simply the signal disappeared. I mean, it's like a first order transition. Like for those educated in that field, it was like a critical endpoint. Another way to investigate the universality class is to try some simpler models, other simple models, rather than changing these physical parameters in the original simulations. And one thing we did was try the Q model. The Q model is a very simple model for a stack of particles. And in my view, it is most appropriate for a stack of bricks, where you stack bricks in this fashion, one always resting on two others. If you do that and you start with bricks which may be a little dirty, then there may be some sand in between these bricks, and the sand layer might be a little bigger here than it is there, so this brick might rest on that lower neighbor more forcefully than on that lower neighbor. And the Q model makes that into the abstract notion that every brick supports some forces from above, and the load it supports, it divides over its two lower neighbors by arbitrarily and randomly. Of course, you have to still decide on the random measure it uses to distribute its force over these two neighbors, but it does it independently from all the other bricks. You can do this in a gravity field, but you can also do it in a vise without gravity. Simply, there is a force here, and that force trickles down through the system.
And you have to start from the top to construct it. Right?
Yes, it is directional. It is chiral. We tried this Q model, which of course is a very simplistic notion of a granular stack. And we tried it also in a slight variation, where you still have only vertical forces, but we take what we call the force ensemble. We take an ensemble of all force configurations which are balanced, so all the bricks receive a total force from above equal to the forces from below, but all configurations are equally probable. Given, of course, some boundary condition, just say the overall force from the top is one constant. And we, so here are some pictures of the force configuration and of the associated clustering. You see also an anisotropy in this picture, and that can be treated. I'm not completely convinced that we treated it correctly, but in any case, what came out is similar scaling pictures. The data are much better because you can get much better statistics, obviously. It's very simple. The exponents are rather different. The nu is much bigger here. It's here it is similar. And the phi is also different enough to clearly distinguish it from the ones we had before. Sorry for the notation here. N is the number of particles, rather than what we used before, L, the linear system size. So you'll see this more and more.
Could you say again what the difference is between the force ensemble model and the Q model?
Sorry, the difference between?
What is the difference between?
Well, the force ensemble model, so the topology of the force is the same.
Yeah.
In both cases, I just deal with vertical forces between diagonal neighbors.
Yeah.
In one case, the distribution is such that you calculate it from top to bottom. You say the top layer all has the same load, for instance, and every brick decides independently from all other bricks how it distributes its load over its two lower neighbors. And in the other model, the force ensemble model, I take all force configurations, the global force configurations, equally probable.
But they have to satisfy the constraint.
They have to satisfy the constraint, but given within that constraint, all are equally probable. So there's no independence between the decision of one brick and another brick. Bricks talk to each other. Well, scaling seems to work. The exponents seem to be different. So the Q model is not accepted as the correct universality class, because obviously this molecular dynamics is much better. Even though I won't defend it to be the honest truth, it's still better, closer to realistic granular matter than this Q model. Now we started to look at a slightly more realistic but still very simple model, equal hard disks in the force ensemble. So we come back to this force ensemble that you questioned about, but now I take just hard disks, absolutely hard disks. To explain that in more detail, I take some arrangement, this arrangement we call the Snooker model, for obvious reasons, but it doesn't have to be triangular. It's just a triangular lattice of spheres, of disks, if you wish. The positions are just the lattice positions. The forces are radial. There's no friction between the radial between the centers of the particles. Since there are three forces per grain, and there are two stability constraints per grain, there is 1 degree of freedom left over in the total phase space of forces, right? So I have in principle an extensive entropy, and I have some phase space of which the dimension is equal to the number of particles. So I take that ensemble. The ensemble is given by the fact that all forces are positive and all forces are balanced. And I take equal pressure, isotropic pressure in principle. Now equally probable, of course, it's a probability density, it's a continuum density, but I act as if forces are canonical variables. And I can find this ensemble by doing not molecular dynamics, but Monte Carlo. Take a Monte Carlo process so that in the after a long time I get this ensemble out. And having generated a configuration picked from this ensemble, I can then do the same threshold trick and find at high threshold or at low threshold different clusterings, and I can measure the clusters again in the same way as I did before. I get these different mean cluster sizes, and they fall on top of each other quite beautifully by scaling them. Again, exponents, no. This is also in the particle number rather than linear size, but you will accept for me that it doesn't really matter. There's a factor of two in here and there, different. The exponents within the tolerant, within the uncertainty that we have measured them, seem to be the same.
Yes. As the molecular dynamics.
As the molecular dynamics, not as the Q model. Yes. And that was actually quite, we liked very much, because that allowed us to use this model as perhaps something, a model that is open to more mathematical analysis. And just to make an extra check, we combined the molecular dynamics data with this force ensemble in the Monte Carlo situation, and it seems to collapse acceptably.
With the same exponents.
With the same exponents, yes.
So this entropy doesn't play a role. I mean, somehow we can move from.
You say it doesn't play a role?
I'm asking what is the role played in this entropy? It seems like you have a lot of freedom of assigning the force to this thing, right? Because the balance will not be broken.
That's
by.
Randomness.
Yeah?
That's the randomness.
That's not some.
That's the space you're doing the average.
Okay.
Yeah, so it is that. Yeah, so I have some partition sum. Or some ensemble from which I select my my data, for which I select realizations, and those realizations I average. Yeah. Now this is work in progress.